A year and a half ago, WBEZ Chicago reported on Legionnaires' outbreaks at the Quincy Veterans Home. Today, the families who lost loved ones are still waiting for justice. Plus, the number of Illinois residents born in Asia has been growing over the past few years. As we think about our declining population overall, we'll talk about who's actually coming to Illinois. And the Lincoln Museum in Springfield now has a Bible that belonged to the former president. We'll hear from the museum and the family that decided to give it to them.
The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, WNIJ in DeKalb, and WCBU in Peoria.
That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Coming up today, do you know how to dispose of hazardous waste in your house? We'll talk to one group in Normal that's helping people in their community. Also, the family that just gifted a Bible belonging to Abraham Lincoln back to Illinois. That family joins us to talk about their donation. But first, it's been more than 18 months since WBEZ reported on outbreaks of Legionnaires' disease at the Quincy Veterans Home. In the last 4 years, 13 residents died. Dozens more became ill. A dozen families have sued the state of Illinois over the way the situation was handled. This even came up during the governor's race last year. But now that the office has changed hands, those families are still waiting for some closure. For more on this, I'm joined by WBEZ's Dave McKinney, who's been following this story since the beginning. Hi, Dave. Thanks for coming back on the 21st. Good morning.
Hey, Nala. Thanks for having me.
So, Dave, I wonder if you can just kind of explain to us what exactly are these lawsuits that the families filed and what they're still waiting on?
Well, a lot of these cases date back to 2016, and then they kind of came, you know, in waves after that. And these are lawsuits that are filed against the state of Illinois through, in an obscure legal venue known as the Court of Claims. And the common thread in all of these cases, basically, is that, you know, many of these folks that were residents at the Illinois Veterans Home in Quincy had been, you know, in decent health, and then one by one they got sick. They weren't being told about what was going on at the home then. Of course, you know, the staff and the, you know, all the way up to the state public health director and state veteran affairs director at the time, they knew that there had been multiple cases of Legionnaires at that home, and, you know, people weren't being told about that. So these cases all kind of revolve around that, you know, lack of notification, that lack of proper care at the home. Our reporting showed that there was, you know, an accidental discharge of up to 1,600 gallons of stagnant water into the home's drinking supply that, you know, while they were servicing a hot water tank. I mean, those are the kinds of issues that are coming up in these cases. They're all pending. And so that's, you know, these families are kind of in a waiting game right now.
And that was under the Rauner administration that all of this occurred. Governor Pritzker, since he has taken office, has talked about this. What has he said about this issue and what he wants to have happen?
Well, of course, Governor Pritzker made this an enormous campaign issue against Rauner because, you know, he kept talking on the campaign trail about Rauner's, you know, the phrase he used, fatal mismanagement of the situation at Quincy. And, you know, he forced a debate, a gubernatorial debate in Quincy that really kind of put Rauner on the spot there. And there was a campaign commercial that was built around Quincy and what happened there with one of the families. And so, you know, he used this issue to get elected, among many others. But it was a pivotal issue for him. And since then, you know, he's been asked really about these families now, and he keeps saying he thinks that they deserve justice. And when you try to pin the governor down on what does that mean, there's not a very clear cut answer. I mean, you know, one thing that Pritzker and his people have said repeatedly is, well, look, this is not our decision about how these families are compensated. That is in the purview of the state attorney general, Kwame Raoul.
And so Kwame Raoul, so that's where all these lawsuits are now, in his office?
He's acting as the, you know, the legal representative for the administration, for the Pritzker administration here. So, you know, there have been discussions that have started, settlement talks with these families have started. You know, but it's a real open question about what these families are going to get. I mean, if you go back in time a little bit, there was legislation that passed that was driven by the reporting and driven by everything that was going on under Rauner. There had been a $100,000 cap on the awards that any of these families could get if they were to succeed in this litigation. And when we wrote about that and how it was really at that point the lowest in the country and had been in place for decades, the legislature moved to increase that cap up to $2 million and write the bill in a way that was retroactive to include all of these families' lawsuits. And so, there was a battle with Rauner about that, and ultimately the legislature prevailed. And that is the law now, that these families could be in line for $2 million apiece. But it's a real open question as to whether any of them will get that.
Dave, the families have also said they don't want this to happen again to any other families. And when we think about, I know the Pritzker administration recently ordered an audit of all the Illinois veterans' homes. What did that say?
Well, I mean, it was a 22-point report. I mean, it kind of gave a real upbeat, optimistic look of things. And it was done by a consultant that this is the first that we have heard from them in dealing with Legionnaires or these veterans' homes. So, it's a little bit, the governor himself has not made much of an issue out of this. I mean, I think, he started in January signing a bunch of executive orders, and this audit is an outgrowth of one of those executive orders that he signed. He wanted, basically to kind of understand, what the health and safety plan was in each of the state's four veterans' homes. And so there's a report now that summarizes kind of what's going on with Quincy. But as I said, it doesn't really go very deeply into the weeds as some of our reporting did and audited by the state auditor general. I mean, as far as Quincy goes, one of the things it talks about with Quincy is that some of the sidewalks there are in disrepair and they need to be fixed, So, I mean, it's kind of it doesn't seem like it's a real groundbreaking kind of report that has people talking.
And what are the families saying about all of this?
Well, as we talked about, I mean, I think they are just waiting to see how this all gets resolved. I mean, besides the civil component of this, there's also an ongoing, we're told, ongoing criminal investigation by the Attorney General's office that was started under Lisa Madigan, and it's moved into Kwame Roll's, authority.
Mm-hmm.
And so those things are still out there waiting. But the families are just looking for closure now. And they knew that Pritzker made this such a big issue on the campaign trail. They've all been looking to him to kind of deliver on these campaign promises and get this thing taken care of. And, a big thing that he has done, this first budget that he's going to be putting into place here very shortly contains $230 million, which is going to go toward a rebuild of the Quincy Veterans Home. So that's a significant capital investment by the state of Illinois that's coming from this reporting and from the tragedies that these families faced. And so, that's kind of what they're looking for. But they're looking for closure. They want these lawsuits settled. They'd like to see what happens with the criminal cases resolved. And both of those things still kind of are a bit amorphous right now.
WBEZ's Dave McKinney. As always, we'll tweet out Dave's reporting on this. Dave McKinney and Tony Arnold have been following this issue for the past 18 months. Dave, thank you for being with me. I appreciate it.
No, it's a pleasure.
Okay, so when I say the term hazardous waste, that might make you think of glowing radioactive material, but actually hazardous waste can come from products many of us use around the house. Things like drain cleaner, furniture polish, even mothballs, and you're not supposed to throw those items away. They're meant to be taken to special collection facilities, but those aren't that easy to find, it turns out. So the cities of Bloomington and Normal are trying to address this with a public-private partnership for people in McLean County. Michael Brown is the executive director of the Ecology Action Center in Normal. That's the group behind this partnership. He's on the line with us now. Hi, Michael. Thank you for joining us.
Good morning.
So, Michael, I think people might be surprised to find that they have hazardous waste within their own household. So I wonder what kind of things are we talking about? I mentioned a few things like mothballs, furniture polish, drain cleaner. What else would be a hazardous household waste?
Sure. So we're talking about anything that's, corrosive, flammable, explosive, or otherwise toxic. So we're talking about harsh household cleaners, oil-based chemicals, automotive fluids, and just a wide variety of materials.
And so are those normally labeled? Does it say, how would you know that it's hazardous material, Michael?
So yeah, the labels on these materials do tend to have a warning label speaking to being toxic or needing some sort of proper disposal.
And when we, and how do you know, and then how would just kind of the average person know how to dispose of these things in general? I wonder how many people call you, or if there are people who are just wondering about how to dispose of these things properly.
Yeah, so we get calls for our community on a daily basis about these materials. There is a lot of, I think, ambiguity and question about how to deal with them. People do want to dispose of them properly, but don't always know how to do so. And so calling us or other local solid waste agencies is a pretty common first step for most residents.
And how does it work in McLean County in terms of right now, are there certain days or certain locations where you can take hazardous waste to properly dispose of it?
So we act as the solid waste agency in McLean County, and that means traditionally we help coordinate this. Traditionally, it was with the state of Illinois, the Illinois EPA, who did historically provide for very adequate and regular one-day collection events, and that's pretty common for most downstate communities. Unfortunately, with the recession and the impact on the state budget at that time, the regularity and dependability of these collection events really went away. And so since then, there really hasn't been a real reliable option for most downstate residents.
And how have you all tried to fill the gap in Bloomington Normal then, in McLean County?
So we created what we call the McLean County Household Hazardous Waste Fund. This is a unique private public partnership in order to essentially try and fill the gap until the state funded events resume on a more regular basis. And so essentially using some local funding through local governments, the City of Bloomington, the Town of Normal, and McLean County, we then supplement that with fundraising from private sources, and together we're able to fund essentially an every other year household hazardous waste collection event.
So, Michael, I wonder what you guys have to do to properly dispose of this. I imagine this can be an expensive process.
It's extremely expensive. And so essentially we have to hire a licensed hazardous waste company that brings a team of chemists to identify, bulk up, transport all these materials that are collected, and then eventually they do have to dispose of these all properly. So all this is extremely expensive. So an average event for us costs about $140,000, $150,000 for one day.
Wow. Okay. And then what happens if you were not collecting this? So what happens if these materials are, if someone just puts them in the trash, which I get, imagine that's probably where most things end up, like if something just ends up in your regular trash.
Right. And so a lot of things may end up in the trash, but even before they get to the trash, so there's just the exposure around the house for children or pets or even adults. If this stuff accumulates, just the dangers of exposure, you know, children getting poisoned, the flammability of some of these materials. But then, yes, in the absence of proper disposal options, these things get flushed down the drain, get into our water supply. They get dumped down the storm sewer and into our water supply, or they get put into a landfill. And most our conventional municipal solid waste landfills are not designed to contain these types of materials. And so over time, these will corrode through the liner and again get into our water supplies.
Mm-hmm. So, Michael, I know you're fundraising now for an event, and you're hoping that this fall you'll be able to have another collection day for McLean County?
Yes, we just started our fundraising effort right now. We already have several sponsors on board from local companies. Of course, we have good support from the local governments to make this happen. But we're seeking private donations at this point, have a goal of raising about $35,000. And I think we're already at $8,000 towards that goal.
We're speaking with Michael Brown, who's the executive director of the Ecology Action Center in Normal. And Michael, of course, your event is limited to people in McLean County because, as we're talking about this funding situation, because it's not funded through the state. Where could people who aren't in McLean, we've got folks listening from lots of other counties throughout Illinois, what should they do about, first of all, figuring out if they have something that's hazardous, where can they take them? What are their recourses?
So the signs are good from the state that we might be returning to more regular, more frequent collection events funded by the state. This spring, they did fund more events than I've seen in the past, 10, 12 years. And so that's the promising news, that hopefully it will become more common and more available for more residents. but in the absence of that, there are 4 permanent household hazardous waste collection sites open to any Illinois residents. They are largely up in northern Illinois. There's a few in the Chicago area. There's one in Rockford. So those sites are available to any Illinois resident, and they can look that up on the Illinois EPA website.
And I imagine you have some thoughts about how people can avoid even accumulating hazardous household waste in the first place in terms of using things like drain cleaners or things like that.
Sure. So source reduction is the biggest strategy, the highest priority in the solid waste management hierarchy. So that means essentially trying to avoid or reduce our generation to begin with. And so using safer alternatives, which increasingly are available at, various hardware stores, grocery stores, wherever you shop, that's a key strategy. Buying appropriate amounts of materials, and so you don't have leftover waste to dispose of at the end, that's another key strategy. But then finding other residents that might be able to utilize your materials through online sources like FreeCycle or Free Pages on Facebook, places like that.
That's Michael Brown. He's an executive director with the Ecology Action Center in Normal. Lots of tips there. We will tweet out some more information from them. And as we said, more information about where you can find a place throughout the rest of the state to donate. We'll have that at our website at 21stshow.org. I want to thank Michael for being with us. Thank you for taking the time. I appreciate
it.
Coming up on the 21st after the break, we often are talking about the people who are leaving Illinois, but what about the people who are adding to Illinois' population? We're going to be talking about one of those groups coming up next on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Every year, thousands of people leave and move to Illinois. Of course, in recent years, there's been more people leaving than coming. I'm sure you've seen those headlines by now. The question of who's leaving and who's moving in is more complicated than just those headlines. We know, for instance, that middle and higher income Black residents are leaving Chicago for cities in the South. High school students have been leaving Illinois for out-of-state universities, mainly for financial reasons. But if you look at the Chicago area, the number of immigrants from Asia has been increasing quickly. In fact, since 2010, the number of people living in the Chicago area who were born in Asia increased by 60,000. That mirrors a national trend of Asian Americans being the fastest growing group overall. We wanted to talk about that with a few people this morning. Andy Kang is the executive director of Asian Americans Advancing Justice Chicago. He's on the line with us now, along with Representatives Teresa Ma from Illinois' 2nd House District and Rob Perrell, a demographer with the Chicago Council on Global Affairs. All of you, welcome to the 21st. Thank you for being here with me this morning.
Hello.
A pleasure.
Before we get started talking about just this demographic shift, I wanted to ask you, Andy, I wanted to just ask about the latest news over the past week on immigration. Last Monday, the president said he was going to order mass deportation raids by Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE. Then on Saturday, that was supposed to happen yesterday. And then on Saturday, he said he was going to delay that. I wonder how these kind of directives or missives coming from Washington are affecting the communities you work with in Chicago. Andy?
Yeah, so I think it's unfortunate, but that news definitely alarmed a lot of folks in the community. Roughly 1 in 7 Asian Americans are undocumented in Illinois, and so we have over 71,000 individuals, but not just these individuals, but their families, oftentimes mixed status immigration families that are, have a deep level of anxiety to the news. But I think it's important for us to remember that President Trump's announcement coincided with his reelection launch. And so it's unclear. It's always unclear about how serious and committed he is to some of the things he says and tweets. But in addition, maybe the more nefarious, unfortunate motive is we know that the citizenship question case before the Supreme Court is likely to get decided very soon. And unfortunately, based on the documents we've seen in the litigation, that it's clear that it's a part of a conservative strategy to stoke fear in the American community. And I think, sadly, I think this is another effort to do just that.
Representative Ma, you are representing the State House, Illinois' 2nd House District, which is, when I was looking at the map this morning, I would say one of the most diverse districts in terms of neighborhoods and ethnicities in Chicago. I wonder how your constituents so you represent part of the city's south side, south and I guess southwestern sides. What are you hearing from your constituents about President Trump's statements?
Well, there is absolutely a lot of concern and fear, and we're doing our best to make sure that people have the right information that they need to know their rights and know how to respond if they are targeted. It's just really outrageous that the president is using these kinds of tactics to divide people in our communities. We're absolutely very concerned.
So I wonder if we can talk about the numbers and the population changes and the demographic changes. And Representative Ma, I just wanted to stay with you for a minute, because when we think of your district, so it's parts of Chicago South and Southwest sides, including Chinatown, but it also includes Bridgeport, which is famously the home of the Dailies. How has your district changed over the years? And I'm wondering even if you've noticed a change since you first took office 2 years ago.
Yeah, I think there's been a lot of growth and change in the neighborhoods in my district. I've lived there for 13 years, and I've seen that change throughout the entire time I've been there. I think that people don't realize how diverse a neighborhood like Bridgeport has become. It's not the same Bridgeport that people imagine in the past.
Right, it's not the old Irish Bridgeport, right?
Exactly. I mean, it's about evenly divided between Asian immigrants, Latinos, and ethnic whites. In the other neighborhoods, for example, McKinley Park, which is just adjacent to Bridgeport and where I live, I think the neighborhood is increasingly becoming or having more Asian American residents, and the majority of the population is Latino. So McKinley Park might be like a microcosm of my entire district, which is a little over half Latino, a quarter Asian American, and the rest white, and with a small percentage of African Americans.
That's Representative Teresa Ma, actually the first Chinese American elected to Illinois' General Assembly. We're also speaking with Andy Kang from Asian Americans Advancing Justice Chicago, and Rob Perrell is with us as well, a demographer with the Global Cities Program of the Chicago Council on Global Affairs. Rob, when we're looking at the trends, the demographic trends behind this, when we're thinking about Asians and Asian Americans moving to Illinois, is this mainly in the Chicago area, or where are we seeing this influx coming?
The majority is definitely in the Chicago area, and it depends a little bit on the group. Chinese immigrants disproportionately live in the city of Chicago. Indian immigrants disproportionately live in the suburban part of Chicago. But because of the kind of jobs Asians hold and the kind of visas that immigrants have, there are Asian populations around a lot of the cities throughout Illinois, Bloomington, Normal, Champaign, Illinois, anywhere you've got a university. The majority is definitely in the Chicago area.
And Andy, to Rob's point, I mean, when we say Asian or Asian American, it's an incredibly broad category, right? Like, so I'm Asian American, but my family's from Trinidad, but we're originally Indian. So I'm in the Asian American category. You're in the same category as I am. So I wonder, as we think about that category of Asian or Asian American, if you can kind of break out for us who the biggest groups are, especially when we're thinking about Illinois and the communities we have here.
Yeah, sure. I mean, some of the biggest communities are very well known in the South Asian community. So Indian Americans, Pakistani Americans are the, easily the largest group in our state. Korean Americans, which I my parents came from South Korea in the 50s and 60s, the Filipino Americans, and then obviously, as Rob mentioned, we have a very thriving Chinese American community in our state, perhaps one of the only Chinatowns that is continuing to grow in America. And so those are some of the big ones, but some of the smaller groups that are, I think, sometimes folks aren't always on the top of their head, or, you know, our Southeast Asian community, as well as our refugee community and Muslim American community that especially recently have been coming in our city in, I believe, larger numbers.
And I think, Andy, when we're talking about this, we talk a lot about why people leave Illinois, but I wonder what you hear from these groups, why they want to move to Illinois, and specifically why they are coming to, as you mentioned, Chicago has a Chinatown that's one of the few Chinatowns in the U.S. that's actually growing.
Well, yes, and specifically in Chinatown, we've seen a lot of Fukienese, folks from the Fujian province. Now, defer to Teresa on that, but we know that over the last decade, that community, which is different than the, you know, folks that came over from Hong Kong and speak Cantonese, that has really grown. But the three things we hear a lot are specific jobs. They came here for work. As Rob mentioned, school in particular plays a big role, and then families. So family-based immigration is still, you know, a heavily used route for a lot of our community members to come to this country. The backlog and the wait times are extremely long, so it depends on when folks are actually able to come over legally and be reunited with families on a permanent basis. But those are some of the trends that we hear often talking to our community members.
Representative Ma, I wonder if you could speak to what Andy was just talking about within your community and what you hear from other constituents about why they are coming to Illinois.
Yeah, I would say the family-based visas are probably the top reason that there's been growth in my area. The area has been home to Chinatown for over 100 years, and family members that get their citizenship are able to sponsor immediate family. Sometimes the visa or the waiting period takes such a long time that, you know, the immigration is not immediate, but over the years, it's our community's been a gateway to the United States. You know, where family members come and stay with their immediate family until they get on their feet, and then they may move to another part of the neighborhood or another part of the area. But there is a lot of family-based immigration driving the population increase. We're also very close to a number of universities, so we get students who live nearby and maybe come to Chinatown for meals and to gather with friends. And they, you know, if they decide to stay and get jobs here, they may already be familiar with the neighborhood, so they can move in nearby. So, yeah, all of those.
Yeah, so it sounds like lots of different reasons. Yeah, Robin, when we're thinking about this, when we're thinking about the economic profile of these immigrants, are we thinking, I think that oftentimes people do tend to think of university students or the sciences. Are Asian immigrants moving here primarily for high income, or are there lower income jobs? Is it kind of run the gamut?
That's exactly the fascinating story about Asian immigration. Asian immigration is just vastly more diverse than either Latino immigration or European immigration, because you include people who have literally the highest skills one could obtain in our worldwide economy, very high-skilled people that come here on employment-based visas or come here to teach in a university. They come on temporary and permanent visas. And then you've got people who are extremely working class. And the interesting thing is that the fact that Asians have among them both the highest educated and some of the lowest educated people, it actually fits our economy, because the kind of jobs that we create in the United States, for better or for worse, are totally split in two. And they're high skilled. We can't get enough high skilled workers in the United States. And then there is just an explosion of low skilled jobs. So that's some of the impetus behind Asian immigration, is that they have skills that are sought in this economy.
Andy, do you think that in this conversation, what's particular when we're talking about Asian immigrants, that we tend to leave out a big part? Are there people that we leave out of this conversation?
Yeah, I mean, to Rob's point, I think it's on the lower end of folks that are working manual labor jobs and low-skill jobs. Folks tend not to think of our community members on that side of the spectrum as far as income and wealth. And, you know, this just a lot has to do with the model minority myth, thinking that, well, that all Asians are crazy rich Asians, for lack of a better term, which is not the case. You know, we have some of the highest poverty rates among our seniors in the Chinese and Korean community. You know, anyone who goes to a specific Asian enclave, you'll see folks that are absolutely working class and are working lower paying jobs to provide for their families and aren't all tech engineers and foreign students. And so I think those tend to be the community members. I think of a lot of our smaller communities, like the Mongolian community, that people don't always think of when they think of Asian American in that term.
And when we're thinking about these numbers of folks coming to Illinois, and particularly to Chicago, Representative Ma, I mentioned before that you're the first Chinese American elected to Illinois' General Assembly. Do you think that are we seeing a political force, or how are you seeing political representation among Asian Americans when we're thinking about state and local leadership in Illinois?
I think we are seeing an increase in representation. So I was the only one in the General Assembly for 2 years, and this year I was joined by State Senator Ron Villavalam and Jennifer Gong-Gershowitz, Representative Jennifer Gong-Gershowitz. And so we tripled our numbers in the General Assembly, but we also have representation at other levels of government as well. Jocena Morita, who's our Water Reclamation District Commissioner, and we have Tammy Duckworth in the Senate. And Raja Krishnamurthy in Congress. So we are seeing our numbers grow in the political arena. I think that, you know, we do have a very diverse population in terms of socioeconomic status. And in my district, I have a lot of working class immigrants, folks who, you know, came because of family-based visas, and so a lot of them, you know, have lower levels of education or English proficiency than those who come because of professional opportunities or higher education. And so we do see this bifurcation in the community of populations that we represent, and.
Right. I imagine that makes things also very different politically in terms of what people want from them. Rob, can I ask you, just as we're thinking about the beginning of this conversation, was just there tends to be so much a focus on the people who are leaving Illinois. When you look at this group that's coming into Illinois, how much of a difference are Asian Americans making in Illinois' population and in the city of Chicago?
Well, incredibly important. In this decade, the average annual growth of Asians is about 15,000 per year. A large portion of that is due to immigration. Chicago, but the state of Illinois more broadly, as it has for many, many decades, it thrives on immigration. It needs immigration, and it's benefited from groups like Asians. And that's why it's such a concern now that we have these efforts to kind of, you know, keep people out and lock people out. It's really about the worst thing you could do for the state of Illinois.
For our economy, for?
For our economy, for our population growth, for the sake of not losing two congressional districts after this next census instead of one, for having taxpayers, for having consumers, for having home buyers, all of those things.
That's Rob Perrell. He's a demographer with the Chicago Council on Global Affairs. Unfortunately, we're out of time, but I want to thank Andy Kang for being with us as well. Asian Americans Advancing Justice Chicago, Representative Teresa Ma, a Democratic State Representative for Illinois' 2nd House District. Speaking of immigration, we're going to be talking more about that on tomorrow's program, so tune in for that. Representative Ma, Rob, Andy, thank you for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Thanks,
it's great to be on.
Thanks for tuning in to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Imagine having an heirloom in your family that once belonged to Abraham Lincoln. That was the case for Sandra Willingham, whose great-great-grandfather, Reverend Noyes Minor, was a friend and neighbor of the Lincoln family. And after President Lincoln's death, Sandra's ancestor was gifted a Bible that once belonged to America's 16th president. And it's been in her family for the last 150 years until now. She just donated the Bible to the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Museum and Library in Springfield, and to share that family treasure with the public. And she's on the line now from Idaho to tell us more about where this Bible has been for the last 150 years. Hi, Sandra. Thank you for being with us.
Hi there.
And joining us from our partner station at NPR Illinois in Springfield is Ian Hunt, the head of acquisitions at the Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum. Hi, Ian. Thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you for having me.
Ian, I wonder what it was like for you guys at the museum to be able to make this announcement last week that you had this acquisition.
It was incredibly exciting. Anything, of course, related to the 16th president, we are, you know, happy to get out there to the public, happy to let them know that we've received it. But the Bible was special. The Bible was unique, and that's clearly been reflected in the way that the general public has reacted to it and certainly in the way that the media has reacted to it.
And so I wonder if you can tell us what was going on in President Lincoln's life when he got this Bible, Ian?
Well, we believe that he receives it, of course, in the summer of 1864 when he visits the Philadelphia Sanitary Fair. And the summer of 64 wouldn't have necessarily been great for Lincoln. He had just received the renomination for the Republican Party, but that spring had witnessed incredibly heavy fighting, a lot of losses, actually. During the Wilderness Campaign, you have General Ulysses S. Grant slugging it out against Robert E. Lee. You have such famous battles as Spotsylvania. You have Cold Harbor. Lincoln is concerned. He is concerned that the American public is no longer going to put up with three straight years of fighting, the massive internal debts that had been risen, and the fact that many Americans were not happy with seeing their sons, their fathers, their brothers being sent off to fight.
So that's the context of the Bible. Sandra, do you remember the first time you saw this Bible when you were a kid?
Yeah, but I would like to clear one thing up right away. My son, William Wolcott, actually is the official donor of the Bible because he inherited from my mother, Carol Hill Lamb. So I just want to make sure that you guys understand that, and I know that Ian understands that too.
So the family donated specifically your son, Sandra.
Yeah, I would say the descendants of Noyes Minor have donated to the Abraham Lincoln Library and Museum.
And so, do you remember the first?
That's how I feel.
Sure. Do you remember the first time you saw the Bible? Then was you thinking about how it was in your family?
Well, I have been thinking about that, and to be honest with you, I mean, it was in my. When I was a toddler, it was in my grandmother's living room. And, you know, it was always there. It was always, you know, part of the furniture. And but I've been reflecting upon when it became more important to me. And I would say that was when I was a teenager and my mother had inherited it. It was on her piano in Oyster Bay, and obviously we were studying American history, and I think we sort of referred to it as, yeah, well, gee, we've got this, and it's fantastic. And so, as I said, really, as a baby, practically, I would say I was in the presence of it.
And it was always known in your family that this was something that President Lincoln had given your ancestor.
Well, actually, he didn't. Mary Todd Lincoln gave it to Noyes Minor after Lincoln was assassinated. It was her gift to Noyes Minor, who had been, you know, their very intimate neighbor in Springfield, and basically had helped them through very tough times, to include the death of their two sons, and then of course after Lincoln's assassination. But that it was her thank you gift to Noyes Minor, because he actually, as a lawyer, never mind a Baptist minister, had helped her secure a pension, you know, a government pension or a widow's pension after Lincoln was killed. He was the one who made that all happen. And so this was her gift to him.
We're speaking with Sandra Willingham, whose family, as we've just been talking about, descendants of Reverend Noyes Minor, who was gifted this Bible, which they have now gifted, her son has now gifted to the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum. Ian Hunt is with us as well as the head of acquisitions for the Library and Museum. Ian, so before this Bible, before you all knew of the existence of this Bible, I imagine you knew quite a bit about Reverend Minor and his relationship with the Lincoln family.
Reverend Minor is one of those figures that predates the presidency. There are a lot of people tied to the Lincolns that kind of pop up after the nomination in 1860 and certainly after the election in 61. But there are smaller groups that we can tie to the pre-presidential Lincoln. Reverend Minor is one of those. He is a neighbor. He lives directly across the street from the Lincolns. He moves in, we believe, in about January of 1855, so he even predates Lincoln being considered for the vice presidency under Fremont. He certainly predates the Lincoln and Douglas debates, and all of this is important because this is clearly not somebody who's simply trying to glom on to someone who's clearly rising up through the political ranks of the country. This is truly somebody who is friends. He has built a personal relationship with Abraham Lincoln.
Mm. And so, Sandra, I wonder if we can get to the story of how this Bible ended up at the library and the museum. I understand you and your husband were on a road trip across the country last fall, and you stopped at the Lincoln Museum in Springfield for the first time?
Yes, and in fact, we had it was not part of our six-week travel plan at all, but we had taken an amazing trip through the South and stopped at all the civil rights museums and battlefields, et cetera. And you know, it just kind of came to me. We have this Bible, and I really wanted to see where Noyes Minor lived. And I actually wanted to know, you know, more about him. We arrived very early in the morning, and the park rangers were there, and I just kind of sidled up to one and said, well, have you ever heard of Noyes Minor? And they were he was sort of aghast and pointed to the actually now empty lot. I'm not sure why it's empty, but it, you know, right across from Lincoln's house. And then the next thing I know, there are about three or four very nice people standing and asking us questions. And then they said, well, we think you need to go over and meet Ian.
Go to the museum, right? Because you were at the home. You were at the birthplace site, right? Or the cabin.
Yeah. And I think we probably would have gone over there eventually, but not in under the circumstances that we were in, you know, like all of a sudden we're in the archives and you know, I think that Ian and Chris were very curious about us and kind of wanted to know if, you know, we were for real. And of course, you know, I opened up the first folder that they gave me, and there was a letter from my grandmother donating all these reminiscences of Noyes Minor's daughter, Mary Minor. And I said, no, wait a minute, that's my grandmother's letter, and there's the Bible. And we all were sort of aghast.
Ian, what was that like? Yeah. Ian, I wonder, how often do you have people like Sandra coming in and saying, oh, I have something that belonged to President Lincoln?
I have people who come in all the time who say that they have things tied to the 16th president. And unfortunately, that's not always the case. So you have a lot of times where you come at things, I don't want to say skeptical, but you come at things without having your hopes up. There have been far too many times people have said, oh, yes, I have this amazing thing. And then you take a closer look at it and you go, you know, that was made in 1956. That couldn't have been tied to the 16th president.
And so what was your reaction when Sandra started telling you her story?
Sandra, the energy with which Sandra had and the fact that she was talking about things that we knew that the average visitor, even the average historian probably couldn't have told you the depth of things that Sandra was able to talk about with Reverend Minor. It was clear that she was connected to him in some respect because he is not a William Seward, you know, Lincoln's Secretary of State. He's not one of these major figures that have had multiple biographies written about them and their relationships with the president. This is one of these kind of Springfield connections, and she was able to tell us things right off the bat. And we said, you know, this is something that we need to pay a lot more attention to.
So, Ian, you flew out to California to authenticate this Bible. First of all, how do you even do that?
Well, I should say that the authentication process began long before the director, Director Alan Lowe, and myself boarded any plane. We were talking with Sandra for weeks. She was kind enough to have photographs sent of the book to us. It was a lot of going back and just doing research on Reverend Minor's relationship with Mr. Lincoln, which we already had a good grasp on, but we wanted to dig more in depth. A lot of it was looking at the Bible itself. You know, does it fit? Does it look? Does it have the correct patina? Is it not published in 1989? Is it, you know, or does it have all the telltale signs, so to speak? And then it was looking at the context of it. Does it make sense that a group would present to the president this during one of the sanitary fairs? And all of it absolutely fell into place.
Sandra, can you describe what the Bible looks like for us?
Actually, it's interesting. I've been looking at more pictures of it that people have been sending me. And I think it is exquisite. And it is, Ian might have to help me out with this, but probably my most favorite part of it, first of all, it's quite large. And Ian, you can help me, it's like 14 and a half inches long. And mm-hmm. I'm not sure, maybe 6 inches.
Like 12 inches wide and 4.5 inches deep.
Yeah.
Okay.
And to me, the most, and a lovely sort of, I would say, forest dark green leather with gold lettering, but a raised, I can't really quite describe how, it's absolutely beautiful in that I've never seen anything like it before, but the most important part to me is that the actual, when you turn it on its side, it is secured with two brass little brackets, very ornately designed, and then the letters, the pages are gilded gold with written in it hope, faith, and charity, I believe, Ian. And it's, you look at it and you just can't believe what you're seeing, because I've never seen anything like it before. And but it's very hefty, and I think, you know, once I kind of really started looking at it and seeing Noyes Minor's name on the back, I'm thinking, gee whiz, you know, this is quite something. And and Mary Todd's dedication to her, mm-hmm. him.
Sandra, what was behind your family's decision then because I imagine this has been in your family, you're very closely tied to the story. What was behind your son's decision to donate this to the library?
Truthfully, when Barack Obama was elected president, we all felt Abraham Lincoln paved his way. And we felt that the Bible had to be given. We actually wanted to give it to the White House, and at that time. And interestingly enough, they kind of went around, because I think they were really, you know, this overwhelmed with everything that was happening in the country at the time. And they actually said to us, well, maybe it should go to the Lincoln Museum in Springfield. And we kind of thought, okay. And but truthfully, you know, I feel that Abraham Lincoln is our most revered president, and we have this connection with him, and we want the nation to have this connection, because he was so extraordinary and such an unbelievable leader, and I just hope we get another one like him soon.
That's Sandra Willingham. Sandra, I want to thank you for taking the time to speak with us, to share your family story, and for sharing the story of this donation with us. Ian Hunt is the head of acquisitions at the Lincoln Presidential Library Museum in Springfield. Ian, is the library on display? Is the Bible on display now?
It is. It is on display in our Treasures Gallery, and it will be on display through the end of this year.
Thank you both for taking the time to speak with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Well, thank you.
Thank you. That's all the time we have for today. Tomorrow, I mentioned, we're going to be taking a closer look at how President Trump's announced plans for mass deportation raids are affecting immigrants here in Illinois. We're going to be checking in with a couple groups on that. Our website is 21stshow.org, and that's a great place to give us feedback if you want to leave us a voicemail, send us an email, find past shows, find information about these shows, find out who works on the show. Just go to 21stshow.org. We are a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening. I'll see you back here tomorrow.